Hello and good evening. Welcome. We'll go ahead and get started. Welcome, everyone. My name is Dr. Juan Manuel Lalape Munoz. I'm a Mellon postdoctoral fellow in the Society for the Humanities and an incoming professor in the Department of Performing and Media Arts here in July. I'm really excited. I can't emphasize enough, excited. About being here today with all of you and with Guadalupe Maravilla. This artist talk is the first in an ongoing series with the Campus-Wide Migrations Global Grand Challenge, part of Global Cornell with support from the Mellon Foundation's Just Futures Initiative. The Migrations Initiative studies global migration for all living things through an interdisciplinary multi-species lens with a special focus on themes of racism, dispossession, and migration. Today, I'm going to start with a couple of introductory remarks to situate Guadalupe's work. Then Guadalupe is going to talk about his work, and then we're going to transition to a Q&A where all of you will also get to respond to Guadalupe's amazing work. In the film Sin Nombre, La Bestia, Bajo la Misma Luna, and Which Way Home, we see accounts of the harrowing conditions that immigrants, and specifically immigrant children, undergo as they leave Guatemala, El Salvador, Nicaragua, Honduras, and Mexico and ride La Bestia, or the Beast, the freight train network running from Central America through Mexico into the United States. We gather from these stories that the protagonists are leaving behind class violence, war and dictatorship, gender-based discrimination, and poverty. They are children going to the United States. Yet what is not represented explicitly or not at length in the films is the places left behind have been the sites of established US imperialism and intervention and military experimentation and multinational corporations like United Fruit Company acquiring land and labor. All historical elements that have contributed to and complicated the dispossession and displacement of these areas and the serial colonialisms that are entangled there. These films and the exponentially growing narratives of undocumented dramas demonstrate a shift in the displaced we that Anna Arendt identified in her seminal 1943 essay, We Refugees. While the UNHCR and each country have their legal definitions of what constitutes a refugee, the marker has become harder to pinpoint. The numbers of displaced persons internally and abroad have grown in numbers, but what has not changed is the systemic conditions that create structures that require one to seek refuge. So although refugees and asylees and the undocumented and citizens are categorically different in legal markers, these categories are not static. A person can move from one label to the other. What unites them is a phenomenological experience, what Giorgio Agamben, in response to Arendt's essay 50 years later, called the challenge of the masses in motion. What I find interesting in these undocumented narratives of the films named above is a hemispheric childhood of the masses in motion who cross borders and who carry those wounds of those borders crossing into new lands and across generations. From this hemispheric perspective, it is possible to apprehend that what we see in the storylines is arrivants who possess knowledge about the conditions and strategies that are needed to survive and thrive in what Gloria Anzaldúa called the borderlands. Some of the narratives have been made legible through the popular discourse of the 2012 Obama-era Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals executive orders that led to the popular refrain of people who are documented. Yet many who are undocumented cannot become documented and did not fit model migrant myths proposed by dreamer narratives. If the figure of the migrant is the quintessential icon of the 21st century, the result is not simply that we need to understand her, their, and his experience to sympathize with their experience, but that we need to take seriously her knowledge production generated from that experience beyond one storyline. So alongside a film and protest poster art, which was and continues to also be an important avenue for promoting immigrant rights, what does performance offer to these discussions, and how does its circulation and production animate these concerns differently from other forms? In the last four decades, investigations and discussions linking performance to US immigration policies have flourished. So we have many museum exhibitions, single author projects, and edited collection that share an interest in one, understanding how national borders function as a site of enforcement beyond their physical location around the periphery, and how performance visibilizes that restriction. Two, considering border performances as sites that not only reflect enforcement measures, but also practices are practices for political, social, and immigration change. Three, assessing the important role of theatrical performances for immigrants to stage competing ideas about the nation. And four, evaluating how the performative elements of the law shape racialization and gender processes across borders. So at the center of all of these concerns is evaluating the animated relationship between the conceptualization of the border, like what a border is, and a performance's ability to shape and reshape that course around such a divisive topic. So I see in Guadalupe Maravilla's work and his various performances and installation, a healing-centered knowledge production that extends from his undocumented experience. Having left El Salvador unaccompanied and undocumented at age 8 in the 1980s, and in 2006 becoming a naturalized citizen in the United States, he is part of the undocumented and formerly undocumented scholars and artists, including myself, who are defining the conditions of what Afro-Indigenous scholar and artist Alan Pales calls illegal epistemologies. This is a conceptual discourse that blossoms from people who were made undocumented by coming to the United States, rather than written from those who were given citizenship status at birth and writing about those who are undocumented. So to this network of knowledge formation, Guadalupe offers sound, choreography, retablos, amoshlis or codices, installation, and the central knowledge and the central role that undocumented cultural production plays in generating and transmitting knowledge. More importantly, Guadalupe challenges us to consider how this knowledge production heals people and their bodies impacted by the double wounds of immigration policies and illness. He transforms spaces into sites of ritual, dialogue, convivencia, and sanación. Based in Brooklyn, New York, Guadalupe has been featured at the Museum of Modern Art, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, Whitney Museum of American Art, Queens Museum, Socrates Sculptural Art, the Institute of Contemporary Art in Miami. His work is currently being featured at the Brooklyn Museum as a solo exhibition. His performances are linked to and animated through the social and spiritual. He helped organize food distribution campaigns and vibrational therapy sessions in churches during the pandemic, details of which he will share today. So I'm grateful that the Johnson Museum of Art orchestrated Guadalupe's visit today and is identifying other opportunities for a return appearance. So as fortune would have it, his performance work and mode of working links to my current book project called The Alien Commons, Choreography and Performance Beyond Citizenship. So in it, I identify culturally, racially, and legally marked alien bodies, either as illegal aliens or alien citizens, who articulate their own politics of engagement and estrangement to highlight the oppressive conditions that link migrant petitions for national citizenship to normative gender, birthing, colonial, and racial regimes. It foregrounds artists to explore the theme and experience of alienhood, and in some cases actually claim the term alien altogether. This community marks an alternative geography through the body and their maternal, queer, spiritual, healing, and decolonial performances. These elements that say more about the audience's estrangement caused by economic and legal changes rather than the artists themselves. So it lingers in the gap that is created between the legal and illegal, rather than trying to get people out of the metaphorical shadows without considering how coming out of that space contributes to white settler futurity. So Guadalupe's transdisciplinary work offers much to these dialogues because it holds on to the void space that is created in the movement between these two legal categories and how they shape our bodies, organs, and cells in the everyday, o lo común. So thank you, Guadalupe, for agreeing to my introductory remarks and allowing me to facilitate the Q&A after your talk. And I hope this serves as a start of a conversation in the Alien Commons. So please join me in welcoming Guadalupe to Cornell. Bienvenido.
Hello, everyone. Thank you, Cornell, for inviting me to be here. And thank you all for being present. Before I start, I would like to say that I'm going to share my story, but my story is one of hundreds of thousands of stories that have come from Central America and millions of stories about displacement from all over the world. I'm just very fortunate to be here and to continue to make the work that I'm doing. I'm going to start by talking about my disease thrower sculptures. The disease thrower sculptures are healing instruments. They are shrines, and I show them in exhibitions, and they get activated in my studio when they're being made. But also they're constantly evolving and changing. I think all the work that I'm doing right that I'm showing today is from 2019 forward. I'm at number 22 right now sculptures that I've made since 2019. So they're constantly evolving, and I'm learning them, growing along with them. So the objects that you see in the sculptures, they're objects that I collect from retracing my own migration route. Basically, in order to the process of healing for me takes many different forms, and one of them is that I go back to these places of trauma. I go back to El Salvador, I go back to Guatemala, Honduras, Mexico, and I go back to these places that I crossed when I was 8 years old, when I was unaccompanied, when I was a child, and I go back now as a U.S. citizen, as an adult, and I collect objects from these places. Right? I believe in animism. Everything has energy. So when I'm in a market or anywhere in these countries, I'm looking for a specific energy that these objects may have. Some of them, this is a plastic mannequin hand that has a broken finger, right? As opposed to this very intricate alacrán, the scorpion, right? So I'm thinking about the energy that they have, and then I bring them back to the studio and they become part of the disease throwers. And the name disease thrower comes, it's just a name that I've kind of invented, and it's like really meaning to repel illnesses, repel bad energy, repel just disease. A lot of the disease throwers have these plastic anatomical models on top of them that represent an illness from someone that I know, someone in my family has. In the beginning, it started off was just like an homage to people that had cancer. Like, for example, this one, someone that I knew had lung cancer, so I made this sculpture for them. This one was for someone who had breast cancer. This anatomical model has actual tumors on it, and that became part of the disease thrower. A lot of the work that I do is I collaborate, right? When I go back to collect materials, I also am interested in developing relationships and creating microeconomies around my work. I met this man in Mexico, in Michoacán, and he was making these tiny little very complex shapes made out of this natural material. And I asked him, if I give you a drawing, can you make me a larger one? And that can become part of my sculpture. And he agreed. So I never found him again when I went back, but he was able to make me five of these. So they became like part of the sculpture. Just recently, I met someone that I'm working with that is carving things out of volcanic rock. For me, I give him a design and he makes them for me. Again, very interested in creating microeconomies. I'm an artist myself. I can probably do these things if I put the energy into it, but the whole idea it is to create a microeconomy based on the work that I'm doing. Also really thinking about the Tripachuca, which is a drawing game from El Salvador that you see here in the background. This is at the ACA Miami. And these drawings, so basically I get the walls painted one color and I show up to the space with some markers, and it's a drawing game. I actually used to play this game as a child when I was crossing the border. It was a 2.5 month journey. I had a notebook and we used to play this game. It's a numbers game that you put in a piece of paper and you alternate numbers and it starts to form a pattern. It was like a topographical map. It's like a labyrinth. It's a bond between two people. And again, thinking of microeconomy. So I always have the museum pay whoever collaborates with me, and someone who's undocumented, or maybe depending on the show, someone who's a cancer survivor gets to play with me. This is not a performative act. This happens behind the scenes while we're installing or before the objects even enter the room. We'll play the game. It sets the tone for the energy that I want in the space. You see these embroideries in the back of this installation. Again, those are my drawings. I met someone in the street in Mexico that was making these tiny little patches, and I asked her if she could make one of my drawings really large. Unfortunately, I think we made about 20 of them, but unfortunately she died of COVID during the middle of the pandemic. It was a great loss. You know, the people that I collaborate with become my friends, and I build these relationships. Sound as medicine is something that's really dear to my heart. I actually, while I was doing radiation treatments, I was exposed to the gongs, right? And I've been knowing about sound as medicines. I think I started working with it since like 2012, but the gongs themselves, I actually used them while I was doing radiation treatments. Our bodies are about 60-70% water. In the water in our bodies, we carry stress, we carry anxiety, we carry trauma. And the vibrations of these gongs and many, many other instruments and or vocals can release a lot of the toxins that we carry. And I'll elaborate more on that in a bit. And here's the tripachuca being played on the gong itself. Okay, so I guess like 2 years before the pandemic happened, I got a Soros grant, and I started doing these community circles for the undocumented community. When I was doing this work, I was really thinking about how trauma can manifest into a different type of illness, right? And not that everyone that has a trauma will have cancer, but I directly connect being displaced when I was a child, experiencing war as a child, and my trauma manifesting into a cancerous tumor when I was 35 years old. I was actually doing my thesis when I found that I had cancer during my MFA. So I realized the more people I talked to within my community, I realized that everyone was really kind of struggling with their health in one way or the other. And sometimes it's just really heavy stress. Sometimes the stress has manifested already into a depression. Sometimes the stress is manifested into something more serious. So with this grant, I was able to rent this space in the Lower East Side in New York City. And I would guide these workshops, and I would do sound baths, but also I would hire practitioners from all over the world to come do healing work for us. You know, and these practitioners, like basically anyone from like a mycologist would come, someone would do acupuncture, a therapist, someone from the city of New York that would teach us about where to buy organic, affordable produce, a nutritionist. And then I would hire a Salvadorian chef that she would cook us a nutritious meal, and we'd talk about our experiences, our struggles, and ask questions to the healers that were in the room with us. So this went on for almost 2 years. And again, like I talk, when I talk about my cancer, I consider it to be a blessing. It really opened up so many things for me. I personally, when I was going through that experience, I actually, you know, I did my chemotherapy, I did radiation, I had two surgeries. But in addition to that, I work with healers, curanderos, witches, brujos from all over the world. They just started coming to me one after the next. And, you know, I work with from all these people from Tibet, from China, from Korea, from Israel, Native Americans, curanderos from Mexico, from shamans from El Salvador, Central America, shamans from Peru, Bolivia, Ecuador, Brazil, Colombia, Chile. All of this knowledge just started coming to me, right? And it's like learning about plant medicine, learning a sound as medicine, learning about ancient ways to heal, new ways to heal, right? The gongs that I use are actually, some of them are calibrated to the same sound frequencies as planets. Some of them have the same sound frequencies as the sun, for example, as the moon, and we use that as a healing tool. Something really important that I stress is that I don't believe in healing anyone myself, and I don't believe my disease throws to heal anyone. We're there to open up the portals for the healing to happen. You are your own medicine. You are your own healers. What I do is I provide people with the tools to do the healing work themselves. That is the work that you have to do internally. Here we are with a herbalist, and she's showing us all the medicinal qualities in the East Village in New York City, the weeds growing out and how strong they are. We're making tinctures here. Here's a sound bath. Here we're doing some sort of exercise routines, some Reiki. And here we're having the conversations. Acupuncture with sound therapy. So immediately when the pandemic hit, the community I was working with for the last 2 years got impacted. They lost their work. A lot of the people in the community were like nannies. So that job disappeared. They were making deliveries. Those jobs disappeared because everybody was home. And living paycheck to paycheck, being undocumented in the US, if those jobs are taken away, you have nothing immediately. So it came like as a shock. So immediately they started reaching out to me. Guadalupe, do you have any work for us? Well, and it just kind of escalated really, really fast. Like within like a few days, like I was getting all these calls from the community. And I got my stimulus check, and then I split it into four, and I gave it to four families. And then I put this on Instagram, and I asked for help. Was there anyone out there willing to give donations? I'm taking them. And then my phone was going off the hook, like everyone was calling me. People I didn't know were calling me. Guadalupe, I have a family. I'm a single mom. I have three kids. I have no work. We have nothing to eat. Can you help? Someone would call me a couple minutes later. I'm a trans woman from Central America. I'm in a toxic household. I need to get out of here. I have nowhere else to go. Do you have money for that? And these calls started coming. Like I immediately took care of my immediate circle that I knew, but then all this giant like amount of like calls started coming to me. Luckily the community on my Instagram was giving me a tons of money. I was able to raise around $80,000 in like 6 months. So the money was coming slowly at first. But then I was literally, people would call me and say, okay, meet me here. I have my friend drop off the cash. It was just like passing money around. The only thing that I will ask for them is to actually let me photograph your hands holding the envelope so I can ask for more money. So this kind of went on, but it got to the point where it was not sustainable. After a couple months of this, I was like losing sleep, and I was like, okay, I don't know what to do because like I'm down to $500 and I have this family here, family of six, not with nothing to eat. And I have this other person that just got out of ICE detention and they have nowhere to go. Who do I give the last $500 to, right? And this was a constant thing. And it's like, well, how did I get into this position, right? The system has completely failed these people. And it was very tough making decisions with people depending on you. And I was, then someone recommended me to this pastor in Brooklyn, in Bay Ridge, Brooklyn. And this is a beautiful New Yorker article. If you have time to go, you can even listen to it. It's like a 30-minute listen on the New Yorker website. And he talks about him and what he was doing. He was feeding about 3,000 people per week. And I'm a highly spiritual person, but I'm not religion, but I really believe in his cause. He was also formerly undocumented. So I kind of just started working with him, just joined forces with him. And, you know, I did everything from like delivering hot meals to elderly undocumented people to actually we're working on a roof garden on top of the church. And then with the money that I was receiving, instead of handing it to people, I started buying grains. I would buy 1,500 pounds of grains every week, and I would go with the pastor, pick them up, put it in my Jeep, and take them to the church. We had bags of dry rice, of beans, and maseca, with corn flour. And then they would get distributed into smaller bags and packaged into other donation boxes that came from other places. the church basically turned into a warehouse. Like literally up until like 6 months ago, this was happening. But really, what was really a major blessing was that I was able to continue the work that I was doing before in the church, because healing could not stop. This is before we became vaccinated. We were still going, we're still gathering, and we had no choice. There's a lot of trauma in the space, and we just had to, and people were coming out of ICE detention in the middle of the pandemic, and here they are, right? So we had to continue. That same time, I was invited by Creative Time to do a project, and it's called Spirit Level. And I was really looking at images of the Notre Dame Cathedral during World War II, and they actually put sandbags in the infrastructure of it too, because of all the bombs that were falling, used to protect the infrastructure, but they were still holding mass, right? So it kind of reminded me of what we were doing. We're not holding mass in the church, but we're doing sandbags, right? The healing has to continue no matter what's happening. During the pandemic, also I was thinking about how I, as a child in the middle of the Civil War, I would still walk to school for 20 minutes on my own, right? The kids would just continue their life even though the war is happening. So I started thinking, doing research on how like bags of rice get shipped, right? This is me in the warehouse, like doing my daily pickup and picking up the maseca. And the maseca is the corn flour where we make their tortillas, our tamales, and these kind of things. So it's really important for us. And so for the Creative Time project, we actually got this amazing space in New York City in Corona, Queens, which is where it got really hit pretty hard with the pandemic. It's one of the most diverse places in the world, and the pandemic grew really strong there. So this is the Great Hall of Science. It's a museum there, and we actually had that space. And the idea was to actually create three pyramids of food in the space, along with some sculptures, and do a lot of the healing work there with the whole healing team that I have. And basically, the pyramids were going to be of maseca bags, of the beans and the rice. And there were going to be 42,000 tons of food we're going to have of these pyramids. And the idea was to exhibit them for 2 weeks and then distribute them back to the food bank, back to the church, and then just use art in this way to give back to people in need. So the space was this beautiful space with stained glass. It's really 100-foot walls. I had this projection in the space, and this is a design that I made based on the tiles that were there of an indigenous Mayan hand holding the corn, the precious corn. And I was commissioned to do these disease throwers, and these were the first sculptures that are made that are these tables made out of, they're steel, the skeletons made out of steel. So every time I play the gong, different parts of it vibrate. So I invented this kind of vibrational kind of healing instrument. It was originally designed for people that were hard of hearing and completely deaf, so they can experience a sound bath by feeling the vibration of the sculpture. But eventually it turned into something more than just that, because I was really kind of using this during the pandemic as a way to work deeper with sound therapy in my space, my studio. March of 2021, I had my solo show at my gallery in New York City. And again, this is right when the vaccines, at the end of this show, the vaccines started becoming, started happening. But here we were gathering a group of like 12 per sound bath. I think we did like 30 sound baths in the space. And the seven ancestral stomachs, I'm talking about literally my gut, because I had cancer in my colon. And something that I learned along the way, that if I learn to heal myself properly, I can heal seven generations forward And then seven generations back, because generational trauma is real and it can get passed on to you without even knowing it. So cleansing myself properly by doing the healing work on myself, I'm able to alleviate my mother, my grandmother, and so on back. And then if I have any descendants going forward, cleanse them so I don't pass my traumas on to them. So these are retablos. So the retablos, again, this is like going back to retrace my own migration route. I came across these paintings, and I've always been interested in them because in El Salvador, they don't exist anymore. They're still happening in Mexico. Frida Kahlo was really influenced by this type of painting. And this type of painting came from Europe. It came from Italy, Spain, and Portugal into the Americas. And originally, they're these devotional paintings. They're religious, right? So when a house would burn down and the chickens were saved, they would make they would go to a retablo painter in the town and ask if they could make a painting and describe the story and thank the Virgin Mary or Jesus Christ or whoever for saving the chickens. And then they will put this new painting in their house to protect the home, right? So this eventually came to Latin America, this tradition. So I came across a fourth generation retablo painter. His name is Daniel Vilches. And I told him what I wanted him to make a retablo of my border crossing. And it was like a beautiful retablo that I just told him my story, like traditionally, and then he designed it. But then I said, okay, I want to go further. I actually, what if I give you a digital sketch? Can you make me a painting of that? I'm an artist, so I wanted to have full control of it. So this is the first digital sketch that I gave him. And I said, can you paint this? And then he did this. And then I went back to him and I was, oh, can you make the hand green? And then he made that hand green. And so then we started going back on WhatsApp a couple hundred times for every little detail to the fingernails being a little bit too dark. Can you make it lighter? And so on. So we started building this relationship like this. So during the pandemic, we've made over 30 retablos now. Here's another one. Then I take it, once I receive it, I create this whole frame with it, with the material that I use. The material that I use is this white material that you see here, and all the disease drawers have it. It's a material that I invented while I was a BFA student, like some of you guys are here. And I was putting everything in the microwave during my BFA times. and one day I came across this little piece that came out of the microwave, and I was like, wow, this is gonna be a sculpture one day. So pay attention to the experiments you're doing now because they may pay off later. So this is the skin to the work. And actually they're getting much bigger, they're getting more complex, and we're completely synchronized right now. I'm also going to work with his father also, and then his brother. So some of these retablos may have three or four different signatures on them at some point, because it'll be like a whole collaboration that happens. Again, like it's about building, creating these microeconomies around the work. I don't go back to these places to get affordable work done. I actually pay them the fees that I would pay someone in New York City, so they get paid really well. I think I really pay attention to that. This is another one here, and this one is really talking about after my surgeries, I had three giant scars in my stomach, and I actually got them tattooed, and I talk about how that empowered me, myself. So even like that process of getting tattooed over my scars was part of the healing process. This one actually has, and then, you know, sometimes I put objects on them. So this is like a rock to represent the tumor itself. And this one has a dehydrated tortilla in the frame. And also another layer to the retablos is that I started collecting stories for people in the church. So I've only made four of these. And the whole idea is to, instead of telling my own story, tell a story for someone in the church. And in return, after the, the piece is sold, and after the government gets their 30%, after the gallery gets their 50%, I give this person, whoever shared the story, 50% of my earnings of the sale of the sculpture, or the retablo, right? So this is a story about Aristoteles, who's working at the church, and this is the original photograph. And the church looked like a warehouse, basically. There were just boxes like everywhere. And basically, he was in ICE detention for 19 months. And the only reason he was released because his appendix exploded and he sued ICE and they just released him. That's how he got out of ICE detention for 19 months. This one's also about him. And then he's talking about how his health is deteriorating rapidly even now. Like we're working on his health right now, but when he came out of there, like he did a lot of damage to himself and it's really hard to fully heal. So he has to wear like this boot. Again, his health, like he actually lost a toe because of his health. He had to get it amputated, and I made a retablo about that. And like literally when I called him, he was in the hospital and he mentioned that he had gotten his toe cut off. And the retablo actually talks about how when he was in the hospital, he was, even after being in ICE detention for 19 months, he never felt this low. Getting amputated, getting a toe amputated, he said it was probably the lowest point in his life. And then he mentioned that he'd been really depressed for 2 days, never feeling like this. But then another person came in the other, in the hospital, his neighbor talked about how he was also undocumented and he was just had his eye removed and he also had cancer. They found out he had cancer. All this happened to him. And then he realized, why am I complaining about someone always has it rougher than us, right? And so I made a retablo about that. This is a retablo of a trans woman from Honduras. That was also in a bad situation. They escaped Honduras. They were attacked by the police department and had to flee, and also came to the church and seek for help and for shelter at the church with the pastor. And I made a retablo about her and her journey. I'm in the process of making another one for her right now. This is my exhibition that I did last year in Socrates Sculpture Park, Planeta Huelex. And this is the first time I made an outdoor sculpture. When I teach sculpture, I always talk to my students, I want them to think about the ecological footprint that your sculptures may have. And so for this one, we got 8,000 pounds of recycled aluminum from a scrapyard, everything from refrigerator parts to bicycle parts and so on. Cut them into little cubes and melted them, and that became the material. And then we made these molds for the sculpture. The gongs are there also. We also had a fire pit and also had a medicinal garden around it, ancestral garden. We grew corn, squash, beans, las tres hermanas. They grow together in Latin America. And also we did a lot of plants that were healing plants in the space. And also built a fire pit because we're getting ready to do this really massive sound bath outside. And in one sound bath, we actually had about 1,000 people show up to a sound bath. Also, like I still have issues with my digestion, so I could only eat probably 50% of the foods in the world without getting sick. So I have a very specific diet. So at the end, I grab a lot of the vegetables that helped me in the very beginning, and we pour the hot aluminum into them and cast them. And here's a video of that. Again, that was like part, every time I'm making something, there's like a ritual component that happens during the process of making as well. This is kind of like what they look like afterwards. And then we welded them on the sculpture. Also, this was the first time I actually got to do something for the cancer community. So I invited cancer survivors to come to Socrates, and I performed a ritual with them with a whole team of sound healers that I work with. And this also became an opportunity to have an open mic. If anybody wanted to share any thoughts, here's the microphone. And it's really important because to actually open that space for people with cancer. And what I mean by cancer survivors, I'm referring to anyone that has cancer, someone that has overcome cancer, or anyone that has had a family member with cancer, because there's a type of trauma there. So all those people are invited to come and share open mic. But after the ceremony, I said, anyone that wants to keep sharing, come to the fire and connect with anyone that's there. And it was something really beautiful happened that people went on microphone and talked about their strange like form of cancer that they had. And then they ended up meeting with other people with the same kind of cancer by the fire and become, and that turned into a conversation and between them and a friendship. So it's been, that was a really beautiful moment. A little clip of how it got set up in the beginning. So a lot of the work that we do is really thinking about, you know, when we play the gong itself, like we're pretty much doing Reiki to the gong. So when we play the gong, we're meditating and we're sending vibrations to the people that are there. In that case, like we actually had a fire keeper that is actually a healer that uses fire. And that person was collecting any energy that was being released because we had over 1,000 people. So you imagine how intense that was. This is my current show that I have at MoMA up until September. If you're in New York in May, in June, we're doing 20 more sound baths in the space. We did 34 already.
As medicine is something that's been going on for a long time. And today we're continuing that here, particularly using the gongs. And they have the same frequencies as planetary systems. and different elements, and we use that as the healing tool. That's what we're using today. You know, the bodies are around 70% water, and in this water we carry stress, we carry anxiety, and sometimes we can't even carry trauma, and vibration helps us release those tensions.
So my current show at the Brooklyn Museum, this opened 2 weeks ago. I'll come back to that image. Tierra Blanca Joven. This show is about talking about displacement, four different types of displacement. Tierra Blanca Joven is actually a volcanic eruption that happened in El Salvador. And Tierra Blanca Joven translates to like a young white earth or young white ash. And basically, this in the 5th century, there was one of the biggest volcanic eruptions happened in El Salvador, and the actual Maya civilization, they were actually displaced because there was 19 months of just this ash coming out of this volcano, and they couldn't grow their crops, so they were displaced. The second displacement I talk about is my own. I was displaced because of a civil war. The third one is a video that I'm showing in space of a performance that I did with teens in the detention center. And they're from El Salvador, Central America as well. They were displaced because of corrupt government and gang violence and extreme poverty. And the fourth is actually the objects themselves in the museum's collection because they're displaced and they should be in Central America. So here are installation shots of this. And this is disease throw number 0. And this sculpture is black, but I didn't use paint. This is actually all the ash from all the fires that I did at Socrates. I saved the ash and I made it into a powder and I grinded it into powder, I guess, and then it became part of the material that I use. So it has the energy of all of those healing ceremonies that we did. There's also a sound coming out of this, the conch shells themselves. I put tiny speakers in them, and there's a sound bath that is coming out of the speakers of the conch shells. These are the objects that I chose from the museum's collection to be part of the exhibition. They're all from Central America. I was very honored to go to the space and collect the objects and just choose them to be part of my work. And these are my blood ancestors, but also my sculptural ancestors. They're the artists that I'm really most connected to, that really most inspire me. There's a few retablos in the space. And this hand that I use, I made this design, and it's basically influenced by the Maya. It's a Mayan hand, And there's a melting ice cube that references the immigration customs enforcement. Most of the people in detention are from Central America, excuse me, and descendants of the Maya. This is actually one of my favorite objects in the whole world. Like, actually, that's in the show as well. I've been looking at this object in one of my books since I was like 19 years old, and I can't believe it's part of my show. It's this blessing. And they actually, right before we exhibited, they scanned it and they realized that actually it confirmed is a flute. It's going to be used, exhibited at the Metropolitan Museum right after my show. So I was just really lucky that it actually had to go to Europe for another show, but because of COVID, that show got canceled and it was available. So I was blessed. this is a little video of when I come back from my trips. I just came back from Mexico with 6 suitcases full of things. And I'm just showing you guys my process, how I come back with all these things that eventually become part of the sculptures. And TSA loves to go through my bags and ask questions. And sometimes I do lose some precious things along the way. But I guess that's become part of the process too, dealing with them. And this is the video of the detention center that I was talking about, and I'll show that to finish. And this video, I was invited to do a mask making workshop through MoMA Education. And after that, I asked if we can go outside because it was their time to be outdoors. And because they get to go outside for 2 hours out of the day. Is it a basketball time? So we got to go outside with the mask and actually do a performance.
Okay, vamos a hacer un performance, ¿verdad? Bien rápido.
Claro, agua.
El plan, la pregunta es, estamos haciendo ayer a las 12 de la tarde.
Comiendo.
Okay, so vamos a actuar,
saliendo
están comiendo,
escuela,
¿ok? Con las máscaras puestas, vamos a actuar, están comiendo.
Dame otra, me chido, hombre.
Después le voy a preguntar, ¿qué están haciendo a la una?
Jugando básquetbol.
Y vamos a jugar básquetbol.
Tengo una pelota de básquetbol.
Ok, digo, vamos a empezar. Ahí. Cuando diga 2 de la tarde, estamos haciendo a las 2. Actúen, estamos haciendo a las 2.
¿Mm?
Ok, actúen eso.
En la prensa,
ok, estamos haciendo ayer a las 12.
No,
actúen, ¿cómo comen? Actúen. ¿Cómo se come? ¿Sentados? ¿No? ¿Estaban sentados o comen parados?
No,
sí, estaban comiendo. A la una que están haciendo, bueno, básquetbol.
Vivo.
Están haciendo las dos. Escribiendo, sentados también, escribiendo.
Pisando.
Ok, las tres están haciendo.
Vamos a darle para allá.
Voy a correr.
Están corriendo.
A las 5 que están haciendo.
Béisbol.
Como están haciendo a las 6. Comiendo otra vez a las 6. ¿Cuándo pensás?
Bañándolo, bañándolo.
A bañándose.
Bañándolo, bañándolo.
Bañándose. ¿Cómo se va?
No, pues ya sale acá, pues acá. ¿Qué
estás haciendo a las 7?
A las 7.
Viendo la tele. ¿Cómo mira la tele? Sí,
acostado. Ahí, pues, ahí con todo.
Está temprano.
Ahora a dormir.
No, okay, a las 8 están haciendo.
No, es sleeping, pues.
También, vamos a sleeping. Hola,
sleeping. Hola, sleeping.
Se duerma como los condados.
Como el bug.
No, pues ahí es puro muerto, pues.
A las 9 están haciendo. Todavía a las 9 están
durmiendo. No, bajada.
Bañarse otra vez. ¿Te bañan mucho?
Sí, demasiado.
Dos veces al día.
Dos veces al día. Ok. Tenemos un artista de Hollywood.
A las 8, ¿qué hacen?
De comer.
Ok, comamos, comamos. Come on. Con leche en la mañana.
Una foto para todo el grupo. Veis una foto. Thank you.
Thank you. Just join me again in just applauding for Guadalupe.
Thank you.
So we're going to transition now to a question and answer portion of our talk. And I have a couple of questions to ask Guadalupe, but also I'm going to open it up to all of you. And there's also a Zoom component to this, or live streaming at least. So there might be some questionings coming from that. You know, first, I just want to say thank you for just taking the time to share your work. I mean, it's extensive, but it's so intimate in a way. And so just thank you for that. Mm-hmm. And my first question actually is response to that last video that you shared of the youth in the detention center. Can you talk a little bit more about the masks and the youth's response to the mask? Because it was doing something to the relationship. So can you talk a little bit more how you created the mask and how they how the youth responded to that mask in that space?
Yeah, no, totally. So I guess just to explain a little bit about detention centers, they're all very different. They all work in different ways. Here they were supposed to be waiting for trial, but it's been for one of them, it was 14 months that he was waiting and completely displaced, and they're children. They're 10, 11 years old to, I guess, to 18 in the space. And I guess I played this this game with them to kind of try and understand what their daily schedule was like. And I just thought about, wow, this, imagine you're just doing this and repeating every day. And also you see, you start making bonds with people and then they have to leave and then a new person comes in.
So it's very challenging. So I went in there and did a mask making workshop, and I played this game with them that I actually showed them a mask from Africa, and I was like, okay, guess what country this is from, and then we go to another mask from Peru, and they was like, guess what country this is from, and then I started bringing the things from Central America, and then I started showing them, wow, this is actually, these are your ancestors right here that made these masks, and they're just like asking me questions about that. They never talked, they didn't know it. So we got into, so I started really forming a really beautiful conversation. But also it was really important that I told them my story, how myself, I was undocumented. Immediately they bonded with me. Within seconds, they opened up to me immediately. So the mask making workshop, I always see it as almost like the Trojan horse to get me inside the space, like using art. Right. And then afterwards, it was just that time for them to go outside. So let's go outside. We're able to go outside. And because they were a mask, we're able to record. Normally, no pictures are allowed. But since we had a mask on, we can take pictures and video. So I was able to shoot this video. Yeah. But so and then they actually got really creative with their mask. And they were having conversations as we're making these masks. And I'm actually doing these mask making workshops. I'm actually doing them at the church on Saturday for children there as well. Who are undocumented, but they're not in detention. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you for giving some more insight into that process. So we'll open it up here to the inside of the space. Any questions? We have some microphones that are available. So if you want to ask a question, raise your hand and a microphone will make its way to you.
Don't be shy.
Yeah, don't be shy. So while you think about that, I'm going to check to see if there are any questions out there. No, so no open questions. Oh, you have a question here in the front.
Thank you so much for this talk, a gift for us all. You put so much creativity, but also energy into the world. And it's amazing to sit in the lecture hall and feel that. Mm-hmm. And in your response to this question, but also in your talk, you describe the works from the Brooklyn Museum of Art as sculptural ancestors. And I was just wondering if you could elaborate, say more about your selection process of those and your relationship to those objects. Thank you.
Yeah, so I grew up playing in the pyramids of El Salvador. You know, and the pyramids in El Salvador are not as polished as the ones you see in Mexico and Cancun and these places that are really taken care of. The ones in El Salvador are pretty much ruins. Parts of them are still under earth. Like they haven't even been dug up, like half of them, like the back part, for example, is just like soil and grass growing out of them. Sometimes trees are still growing out of them, but they've been looted, right? So as a kid, I remember going to the pyramids and playing, but there was like, there's no museum next to it. There's no information about them. And where are the objects? Like who made these, right? So as a kid, my imagination was just going crazy. Like who made these, right? So I started doing a lot of research on my own once I got to the US and asking a lot of questions about the Maya and the Pipiles and like just a lot of questions about who my ancestors were. And then so I started becoming obsessed with collecting books. And I, again, like that one image that I was talking about, this one was in part of my books very early. And I connect that with healing, right? It's like someone coming out of a plant. So I was always connected to them as makers, right, as sculptors. And that's what I mean by my kind of artist ancestors. They're the makers. These are my favorite sculptors. And also they themselves were actually, they were shamans as well. Their artists were shamans, and they were healers, they were artists, they were astronomers, they were mathematicians, they did everything. It wasn't like, oh, I just paint, right? It wasn't like that. They did everything. So that's also been inspiration to me, because that's what I'm doing right now. Like I'm trying to do everything. I'm learning, like everything feeds each other, right? The healing feeds the work and vice versa, right? And the many other things that I do. So that's what I mean. They're my, I guess, my artist ancestors, but also the healing, the ritual, all inspired by them. Yeah.
There are a couple of questions online. So there's one that actually says, if you can say something about your jacket that you're wearing.
So this is just like a hexagon kind of blanket jacket that I got. That's all I have to say about that. I actually had that question asked me later in a panel that I did last week.
Indication of how amazing that jacket is. So, there's a question in the back.
Hi, Guadalupe. I was wondering, so much of your work is emphasized or emphasizes building relationships and maintaining relationships and really just kind of creating these communities from the people that you meet and the people that come to the sound baths and that you heal or that learn to be healed. And I'm wondering how you maintain those or how you kind of work to, I mean, like just kind of taking in like capacity and the limit that one has and how you just work to like maintain those relationships and just, I guess, look at yourself and see what can I take on and then also, you know,
Yeah, great question. Yeah, so basically every Saturday I'm at the church, so people know where to find me. And they know that I'm gonna pretty much be doing a sound bath there in the evening. So that's, I'm easy to find there. And the community, the door is open, basically, anyone that wants to come, and not just undocumented community, you know, I have a community of the cancer community is also going to the church now. Former students, friends that are going through depression or whatever they're struggling with, they just show up. So that door is always kind of open for them. And I feel very blessed that the pastor allows me to have that space that I can do that. But in addition to that, like, every time I have an exhibition in the museum, they get activated there. We did 34 sound baths at MoMA already, and we're gonna do 20 more. So people can sign up, like, you know, just have, but yeah, so like and a lot of people ask me, how do you do all these things? You know, how do you stay, you know, like motivated and strong? And it's because it's a healing work that I do, right? I do a meditation every morning. And I'm constantly, every time we activate space, it's giving a lot back to me. Again, when we play the gongs, it's like, I'm not giving my energy. I'm a vessel. I'm channeling the light and I'm playing the gongs. I'm pretty much doing Reiki and the energy kind of moves into space. Right. So actually I feel very energized afterwards. So a lot of the work that I'm doing is stuff. It's everything that I love. So I don't get, I don't get exhausted, you know, like all the young artists here. If you're doing a process that you don't like or is exhausting, don't do it. Don't force it. Just do what you love. And it sounds a little cliche, but it's actually that simple. So I've come to the point in my life that I don't do anything that I don't want to do. I'm not forcing anything. If you start forcing things, it's a difference too. You have to be careful because like sometimes you have to persevere and get through certain things, and that's important. But it's a difference between that and forcing something. So I don't force anything, and that's why I'm able to keep going.
I'm gonna take another question from the virtual webs. Can you touch more on how food intertwines with cultural expression identity in your work? That's from Candace.
Yeah, nutrition is extremely important. I think that, you know, I can't eat most of the food that most people can eat here. But I realized that it has become a blessing. I have such a clean diet. So that, like, even going through cancer, I learned a lot about what the cancer cells kind of can feed off when you're sick, right? And if you start thinking about it, like a lot of the indigenous ways of healing have to do with nutrition and what you put in your body. If you think about energetically about if you eat meat, and I'm not judging anyone for eating meat. I just want to make that clear, but the way the animals are raised in 2022 in this country and most other countries is that they're pumping hormones. And if you see a cow and chicken, they're just like in these boxes. They don't ever move. They never walk on a grass field, right? Unless you're paying extra money for like free range like meat, right? And it's super expensive. Who has access to that, right? So it's very political what you eat. And also thinking about the energy of the animal. Like imagine like being in a cage, cooped in there for all your life, getting injected with hormones. Like that animal was tortured all its life. And all of a sudden I'm putting that into my body, right? And And it's hard because you're putting that energy into your body as opposed to having a free range chicken that's been free, just, you know, so it's a different type of energy. So energetically, I think that food is really important, and it's political as well, because the government has control over this. They have control who gets to eat organic food because of the prices, right? And unfortunately, I wish I could, yeah, even just like when I'm traveling, I can eat organically, you know, because it's not available, right? So it's like, they make it impossible almost to do it. Nutrition is really important. And so many levels.
Any questions? Answer right here, okay.
Hi, thank you for sharing your work with us today. I'm kind of curious about this idea of open-mindedness to these things, to the idea of spirituality. I kind of think to my mom, who is an immigrant from El Salvador, and I feel like if I brought up these ideas to her, she might be a little bit thinking like, he's loco, that's crazy. But she too, you know, has her own health thing. So I wonder if, like, to even get these ideas presented to her, how do you think about those things?
Yeah, and this is something that I deal with every week. You know, so at the church we have people that never been exposed to this, you know, and their form of spirituality is religion, and that's about it. But I tell them my story, and you know, we have workshops that we do in the space before every sound bath, and then slowly they start like believing in it, because the person next to them has been to 40 sound baths with me, and they're telling them how much it's helped them, and they slowly start believing in it. But the way I see it, I mean, I don't have an instrument with me right now, but like I usually just grab one of my instruments and I play it, and I'm like, okay, touch it and feel the vibration of this. And then I explain how we're 60-70% water, and then people just start connecting to it and say, oh, let me try it. And a lot of them are skeptical about furs, but then afterwards they're just like, what did we just experience? And then they become believers and they start coming. But it is about doing this all the time, like weekly, and just kind of getting the trust and just having that trust grow. But ultimately I believe when people are going through really hard moments is when they're like most receptive to different things. So it's like reaching out to the cancer community is super easy, because we are like searching like for a cure, like we're fighting for our lives. So it's every community is different. And sometimes like even like when I do it in the museum, it's completely different than working with the cancer community or working in the church. So it just varies. And I also learned, now that I'm doing it in different countries, like different countries, different people, different countries are responding so differently to it as well. But yeah, sound as medicine is really, if you think about it, vibration, like I you know, there's an eyeball of my cat in this new sculpture that my cat Wi-Fi, and she looks very fierce in this photograph. but she's a vibrational healing instrument. So when Wi-Fi sits on my lap and she purrs, automatically relaxes me. Right. So if you think about vibration, you know, if you think about Tibetan throat singing, they use the vibration, right? If you think about the drumming and the percussion instruments from Africa doing in rituals, that is the type of sound as medicine. The flutes and the shamans from South America also use vibration and sound as medicine. And even the cat does it, right? So when I start explaining it like this, and then they hear the gongs or whatever flutes that we have during the ceremonies, they're just like made the connection. So it's like, so I really believe sound can be medicine. Yeah.
One question over here in front.
If you're comfortable sharing, can you talk a little bit more about your journey as a kid coming to the U.S. and what that transition was like?
Yeah, totally. So I think that it's really important when to talk about, I guess, traumatic experiences when one is ready, and I'm totally ready, but it is part of the healing process. It's like going back to confront these lands that I go to, being open to sharing with one person sometimes is a big step, telling another person is another step. And then eventually I got to the point that I'm very comfortable talking lectures and writing about it, making and being open about it, right? So when I was little, when I was like 4 or 5, my father was considered a communist by the military during the Civil War. So they were coming after him. He was just like a car mechanic and he had to escape. And eventually decided coming after my mother and she had to like leave. So they left us with my grandmother and, you know, Civil War, there's like bombs falling everywhere. And eventually they hired a coyote, a person to cross. I was by myself, like my whole family had left. Because they have different ways out that were easy, and they didn't realize they were gonna have to hire a coyote to get me across. I was 8 years old at that time, and I was able to, you know, it's, I was gonna make this clear, it's very different now, what's happening now, that journey, than it was back then, because it was new when I did it. We were actually escaping the Civil War. Now, for the immigrants that are there, there's all these obstacles set up for them. There's cartels, there's people waiting for immigrants to come across and rob them, take advantage of them, exploit them, so on. So my journey was very different. So I was very blessed that I actually was passed from, I went by land from Honduras, Guatemala, all of Mexico, 2.5 months journey, not communicating with my parents, and I was just being passed from coyote to coyote, person to person. I was there from family to family all the way to Tijuana. And then I was in Tijuana for 2.5 months at the border and eventually I crossed. And again, very blessed. I saw a lot of things that a child shouldn't see, right? But I'm here and I feel empowered by my experience. And again, talking about whatever trauma that anyone has experienced it, one thing is healing from it. And I'm not fully healed from it. I believe that trauma, maybe you have to heal for the rest of your life, depending how it is. It's the constant healing, right? The work. But it's also, what do you do with that, right? So I'm not just here telling you that story, but it's also, okay, what am I gonna do with this, right? How do I help others? Now, that was over 35 years ago, and now how do I help? So I feel like, because I was part of the first wave of undocumented kids to come here, I feel like I have all this knowledge that can benefit someone that just crossed last week. Right, and what's going to happen if trauma doesn't get worked on, right? And how do you heal yourself? So I provide people with the tools to do the healing work themselves. So that is my mission in life now. So, and also cancer survivors as well, the same thing. I have knowledge that I picked up from all these healers, natural healing ways. And sometimes it's like little simple things that the medical industry doesn't tell them that can help them just get through radiation that I know, right? So like those little tips can go a long way. Yeah.
Thank you. thank you so much. I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about your relationship to other Central American artists and performance artists. Like,
yeah, no, it's a great question.
Mm-hmm. Figueroa, people like that who.
Yeah, so I still, actually I don't have any family left in El Salvador, but I have a lot of artists that I've met over the years that are there. So I'm constantly in communication with them and their struggles and their challenges and everything that they're going through. In New York City for a long time, there's not a large Salvadorian community there. Up until the last 15 years, it's changed. But growing up, it was like anyone that spoke Spanish was Cuban and Puerto Rican, Dominican, right? So I didn't really have a connection to Central America. As if I was in Los Angeles, it would have been a whole different experience for me being here in New York City. So that relationship, it's pretty strong still with all those artists. And yeah, they're constantly coming to my studio and like building bonds. Yeah.
All right, well, we have time for one more question and then we will head and then transition. Okay.
Hi, thank you again for this. So kind of given the need for this healing work and the urgency of it, especially right now, given the number of migrants that are entering this country every single day, kind of how do you envision this work being done on a systemic level and into the future?
Yeah, I want to build temples. I want to build these temples that are going to be mainly for the undocumented community and people with cancer or any marginalized community. In some cases, they'll be open to the public, right? And I feel like we don't have this space that someone that is struggling with can walk into without it being religious, right? So I want it to be this space that, a healing space that anyone can use. And I want to devote those spaces for that type of healing, very specific. And I believe in intention, and I put it out there in the world already, so it's gonna happen. I just don't know when. But my idea is to build these giant shrines, like of just my sculptures full of gongs, and have them be run by artists and healers, and for them to actually get paid a fair salary and have health benefits. And somehow, if another pandemic or something else happens, we can turn it into a warehouse and we'll be equipped for that, right? Just to help humanity. So that's my vision, without religion, without government, and without institutional help. So that's the plan. Yeah, I don't know when it's gonna happen, but it will happen probably soon.
Thank you, Guadalupe, and we wanna join me again.
Thank you.